So, well, the title is What If the Universe Accelerates Because Time is Discrete? So, as the title suggests, I want to speak about two things. One is how to include the cosmological constant in our theories, and a positive cosmological constant. And the other thing is how to describe geometrical quantities in quantum gravity that have discrete spectrum, and how the two things are connected. So let me start with framing the problem and picking up some ideas to know where we are coming from and where we want to go. So the starting point for us is a fact, is that the universe expands, accelerating. So when we want to write a plausible quantum theory of gravity, we want to have this theory to account for the presence of a cosmological constant, a positive cosmological constant. And there has been a long effort to do this in quantum gravity, in particular in loop quantum gravity. And this, in fact, dates back maybe 20 or more years ago. And in loop quantum gravity, we calculate, in covariant loop quantum gravity, we calculate transition amplitude between boundary states. So the dynamics that gives this transition amplitude in the bulk has been developed with a cosmological constant by using quantum groups. And the question is how this deformation of the group affects the boundary states. And this is something that has been studied much less. In fact, the study of this started already 20 years ago, as I said, pioneered by Smolin, Borisov, and Major. And more recently, Girelli and Dupuy have tackled again the problem, and more recently joined by Levine and Bonzon. But in the context of a negative cosmological constant, so here we want to ask the same question for a positive cosmological constant. And let me step back. What does it mean that there is a positive cosmological constant? It means that there is some constant curvature. And when we do loop quantum gravity, the standard way to start with is to take some discretization of space-time. So you have some cells, let's say tetrahedra, and these tetrahedra are flat. So they works very well if you want to describe a solution of the Einstein equation corresponding to Minkowski space. But if instead of flat space you have some curved space space-time, you need to add this curvature to the cells. And this is brilliant idea developed by Benjamin Barr and Bianca Dietrich some years ago to work with the curved tetrahedra. And this is our starting point as well, because we wanted to start by some geometry with a constant curvature, in particular a spherical one. And in order to do this, this is, let's say, our contribution, we want to modify the kinematics of the theory that is described by this phase space that is the product of an algebra element times a group element, and replace this group element, this algebra element, with a group element, as it was suggested by the recent work by Haggard, Hahn, Kaminsky, and Riello. So the result is that there is a compactification of the phase space. This yields finiteness. It's a finiteness of the Liouville volume in the classical phase space. And in the quantum theory, this finite Liouville volume can only accommodate a finite number of orthogonal states. So the Hilbert space should be finite as well. So this will be the strategy that we want to follow. We want to start with some uniformly curved geometry. And we want to implement a quantization that yields some finite dimensional Hilbert space. And so this is just an overview, the strategy that we want to follow. And the first technical things that I want to introduce is just a description of how to describe a spherical geometry. And for simplicity, I will just talk about a two-dimensional spherical geometry, a two-sphere. If I wanted to accommodate the phase space variable on this sphere, so I have this two group element. So I have the standard group element that is the holonomy of the connection, as usual in as we do all the time in loop quantum gravity. But then there is also another group element, and now I describe you how it comes into the game. So if I have this two sphere, and I want to describe a triangle on this two sphere. So a triangle is defined by three points on this sphere. And these three points are connected one another by some circles of maximal radius. If now I work with a fixed radius for my sphere, instead of talking about the distances between these points, I can talk about rotations. So the triangle will be completely described by three rotations with respect to the center of the sphere, one that takes this point into this, one this into this, and this into this. So I have three rotations, and therefore my phase space is described as before by a group element that is the holonomy of the connection, but also another group element that is associated with these rotations. So as usually in loop quantum gravity, I can associate this group element instead of with the side of the triangle, I can take the dual graph, and I can associate this group element to links of the dual graph. So notice now that if I consider this construction and I restrict myself to small triangles, I can expand the group element in this way, and I just get back the standard phase space of loop quantum gravity. So what does it mean? It means that if I start with this spherical geometry, characterized by a given fixed radius, and I take the limit for the radius going to infinity, then I am back with the standard phase space where there is the algebra element times the SU2 group element that is nothing but the cotangent bundle of SU2, and I have one of these for each link of my graph. Okay, so there is a precise sense in which if I start with the spherical geometry, I can get back to the usual standard phase space of loop quantum gravity. So in order to understand what, is it my fault?
No.
Okay. If I wanted to understand what's going on, it's useful to start by a simpler example. And instead of considering a phase space that is SU2 times SU2, I take instead U1 times U1. So This is, if again, what is this phase space corresponding to? If those are two circles, so imagine that I take one of the two circles going to infinity, then I have the phase space corresponding to a well-known example, that is the one of the particle on a circle, where so the particle, the position of the particle is bounded, but then the momentum is given by a real number r. So I have u1 times r, u1 times r. Yes, if I compactify the momentum variable, then I get this example that is u1 times u1. And so I can write down the symplectic form corresponding to this example and the corresponding Poisson brackets. And then I can, I would like to consider the quantization of this example. So what I wanted to do, so I'm starting by a system where everything is compact, the phase space is compactified, and this, as I said before, it means that the Liouville volume is finite. When I go to the quantum theory, this means that I want a finite Hilbert space. And so how can I write this finite dimensional Hilbert space? Well, this is the way I can do it. I can start with this separable basis that is labeled by these numbers with a maximal n. I have operators. So my k acts as a multiplicative operator, and h acts as a derivative operator. And because everything is bounded, I want to implement the cyclicity on the states. So if I act with this derivative operator on the ket n, I get back to the first state. OK, I can compute the commutators. I get this result. And now, remember, as we do all the time when we do Dirac quantization, I can compare my commutators with the classical Poisson brackets. And if I expand this exponential, I can identify h bar with 2 pi over n. So now I have h bar that is a dimensional quantity and this a dimensional number. So there is something going on here. I have missed some of my dimensions somewhere. And this is just because of the fact that I have fixed the radius of my circle. So the radius of my circle is what gives me the some maximal length. And there is another length into the game that is just the quantization parameter, that is h bar. So what's happening here is that I have a ratio that is giving me the ratio between the Planck length, the dimension of the Planck length divided by the dimension of the cosmological constant, where the cosmological constant in this picture is just the maximal possible length, namely the dimension, the maximal size of my Liouville volume. So this I have. So in this Hilbert space, I have those operators with a discrete spectrum. And in order to understand what's going on, as I said, I was starting by this example of the particle on a circle. But remember, every time there is compactness, this compactness yields a discretization in the conjugate variable. This is well known. But here, both conjugate variables are compact. And this means that both conjugate variables are also discrete. So if you wanted to go back to the picture of the particle on a circle, so the momentum is discretized, but also the position of the particle on, so the circle is not anymore something continuous. The particle cannot take any position on the circle, but only discrete position. So now we are ready to go to SU2 times SU2, and we want to do the same. So the first question we try to ask ourselves is just, is it possible to write a classically a symplectic form corresponding to this this compact phase space? Well, the answer is yes. Well, you can work out the maths easily. You can write this symplectic form, and you can see that this symplectic form in the limit where r goes to infinity, or when you are considering small triangles, it gets back to the usual standard symplectic two form. But this starting from the classical theory and then try to quantize this is not completely satisfying. A better strategy would be just to start from the quantum theory and in the end, eventually, try to find back what is the corresponding classical phase space. Why do we want to do this? Well, because we have a precise hints, a precise algorithm to write this quantized theory. As I said, so the starting point is the standard phase space of the standard space of loop quantum gravity, and we want to compactify it. Namely, we want to make the Hilbert space finite. So let me start. Before going into what does it mean to make this finite, let me remind you just in a second how is the loop quantum gravity construction made. We have this Hilbert space on each link in the basis that diagonalize the holonomies. I have so the holonomies acting as a multiplicative operator, and I have the operators J acting as left invariant vector fields. And now, if I wanted to write the action of these operators in the basis of the spin network, so here this is the simplest one. So this acts simply here with the generators of the rotations. And it's more interesting to look at the action of this operator here, the operator H, that acts just with these two 3J symbols here. Okay, this is standard. This is a math that every student in loop quantum gravity knows. But now we wanted to do something different. As I said, we have an algorithm to perform the compactification, and this yields to a finite dimensional Hilbert space. So the strategy would be to put a cutoff here so that the spins cannot run to infinity, but there is a J-max. Okay. Yeah?
Is what you're doing is making a construction of the prime loop at the root of the unity, or are you doing something alternative to that?
Well, I'm coming to this. That was exactly the next step, because it's, as you are suggesting, the standard way to implement the finiteness of the Hilbert space is just to replace the representations with the representations of the quantum groups. So the 3J symbols are now quantum 3J symbols. And as you can see here, the parameter that governs the Q deformation, I take it to be the square root of unity. If I would take have taken another choice, then this would yield not a compact phase space, it would yield not to a positive cosmological constant. Different choices of the Q parameter allows to describe a negative cosmological constant, but this is not the case I'm interested in now. Because if I go to a negative cosmological constant, that I don't have a compactness anymore. So here the deformation parameter is taken to be a square root of unity, a root of unity. And there is a relation between the J max, the maximum spin, with the Q parameter. Okay, let's study better what's the action of this operator with the Q deformation. So, is there a question? Yeah.
Sorry. So this autonomy is not unitary anymore?
No, wait. Well, just a second, let me go to the proper. So the construction, so the initial construction is the one you recognize from loop quantum gravity. So your question concerns the replacement of the 3J symbols with the quantum 3J symbols. So.
So I don't think it's unitary, because the question is what happens if you apply it to J and M, that J is a maximum allowed spin,
mm-hmm.
and you have it with one half.
So, yeah.
Then there's a root of unity, there's a subtle point, which is that you get contributions to just the case 0 part of the Hilbert space.
So, have you seen the same question? Because you have studied something similar, I guess, for a different choice of Q. No, you don't, oh, that's right, because you don't have a Jmax in the case of, yeah.
So that's why I'm not sure. Yeah,
I mean,
it's
a bit of
the question whether these things are very defined in this context.
Well, yeah.
So the point is, it's a Leibniz space. And it's not so easy to put this paradox here.
I see.
But it's written in the book. We have to open the book and it's written.
Yeah, no, but then there are many details. And so I'm skeptical that you can do that in this way.
So do you think. Do you think that this kind of operator will not be the... Do you think there could be an alternative version of this?
Yeah, so my claim is that actually instead of... You cannot write your Hilbert space H. In this local data, as you might want to write it, it's not a sensor program because the edges of all these H's. Because what you have to do...
So I think we are in the country.
Yeah, so but okay, what you would have to do is to couple all these Hilbert spaces and then take globally to define out the phase model.
Yeah.
That is a very non-global construction.
You can also start with a finite dimensional hop algebra, so you can already mod out this idea of these problematic parts before, and then you consider the representation of that part.
And then it's okay. So he's looking at that now in 3.7.
It might be.
But it's in the books for sure.
It's in the books. So, okay, we're, what is nice with this quantum groups construction is that mathematicians know them very well, and this is an occasion to take coffees with your colleagues in the mathematics department and involve them in our research. So, okay, so Bianca, I haven't looked at the unitarity. It's some, so this is a very sketchy proposal, but I think it's something that is worthy to ask it to our mathematician friends to for solutions for the problem you are asking about. Okay, so this is the construction I have. I wanted to describe a bit further the action of this operator because it has an interesting property. Naturally, mathematician knows this well. So you see here I have a 3J symbol, I have another 3J symbol, and so forget about the Q for a moment. So this 3J symbol can be represented as usual with the graphical calculus by this trivalent vertex. And I wanted to ask when I act twice with this operator, what happens? So I just have these four legs. I have four free indices. And you see, if I act with two operators, but with a different order, I get this crossing here. And there is a way to this. So if I want now to write down the commutators, the commutator for this operator, what I have to do is to know what is the difference between this action and this other action. And the difference between the computation of this object and the computation of this object is well known by mathematicians doing quantum groups because, and not theory, because the difference of the two amounts to these crossing operators. And if now, so I can write down by my commutator, and I can take an expansion in the quantum parameter that is h bar. So there is an expansion of these operators in terms of an R matrix, and I can write down the Poisson bracket corresponding to the structure of this theory on a compact phase space. So now you see, I asked you to forget about our initial proposal for the symplectic form, because now I have some Poisson brackets that can be nicely written in this way, but now these Poisson brackets do not correspond to a symplectic structure. They are something a bit more complicated, and again, we have to look in the books and ask our mathematician friends, and they will tell us that this corresponds to quasi-Poisson-Lie groups. So again, this is pretty involving to do the calculations because there is a non-commutativity, that a new non-commutativity that appears in the theory, and so the non-commutativity comes from the fact that now, so these operators in the standard loop quantum gravity theory would commute. And now the matrix element, the entries of those matrices, they don't commute each other anymore. And furthermore, not only we have introduced a new non-commutativity, but there is also a non-associativity that appears with quasi-Poisson-Lie groups. So it's a new mathematics that is worthy to explore and investigate. So, yeah.
Why do you call the expansion parameter in front of little r? Why do you call it h bar? This is not the real physical h bar.
Isn't it? Do you have the same in?
We could hit your what you mentioned, the plant cancel.
Yeah, exactly.
So, it's coming from there.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
Well, thank you, Aristide.
But that's where the physical hypothesis is.
Well, yes, I mean, this is not just working with abstract quantum groups. So in our case, the compactness of the phase space from which we started was induced by the fact that we work with this maximal dimension of the Liouville volume that is given by the length, the maximal radius of our universe, given, namely the cosmological constant. Okay. Okay. I summarize a bit, and I go to the end of my talk. So we have introduced a modification of loop quantum gravity kinematics. So careful, as I said before, at the beginning, we are focusing on what happens on the boundary states, not in the bulk. We just wanted to write operators for acting on the states living on the boundary in this case, for what we have done so far for a three-dimensional Euclidean space-time. We have compactified our phase space, and the compactification itself yields the presence of the cosmological constant, of a positive cosmological constant, or vice versa. You can think that introducing a cosmological constant because of these maximal sites of the Liouville volume yields compactness. When I go to the quantum theory, the corresponding Hilbert space should be finite dimensional. And the dimension of the Hilbert space is determined by the ratio of two physical constants. This is what we have just discussed. So there is a physical constant that comes from the quantization, that is the Planck constant as usual. But now there is a new dimensionful constant that comes from the cosmological constant. And so this is this yields the picture of working with geometry with constant curvature, so not flat simplices anymore, but rather having a curvature on our simplices. And having a deformed Poisson algebra. One can prove that taking the Q, so removing the cosmological constant, meaning taking my maximal distance to infinity, or just working on with very small triangles, I can get back the Hilbert space, the usual Hilbert space of loop quantum gravity. So we have introduced this compactness, and so the more interesting result from my point of view is the following. This compactness yields a discretization, it's a discrete spectrum for all geometrical quantities. So not only the intrinsic curvature here is discrete, but also the extrinsic curvature should come out discrete with a discrete spectrum. So if I think about if I think to the extrinsic curvature as a rate of change of the 3D matrix. So what I get is that I can expand this, and all the quantities involved here, they are all discrete. And in particular, I have also this proper time that should be discrete as well. So careful here. It's not that time has a minimal time lapse. So this is not just the fact that I can define the Planck time combining the fundamental constant. Here there is something more. So if I could, this is something I would like to do, or I would propose as a project to a student, if I could define a operator corresponding to time, to the proper time, then in this construction, this time operator would have a discrete spectrum. So you can run the argument back and say, so general relativity yields a democratization of space and time. Space and time should be treated on an equal foot. So we know that quantities such as area, volume, and so on, they all have a discrete spectrum. I want time, the operator corresponding to time, to have a discrete spectrum as well. If I want to implement a theory with this feature, this theory should yield a positive cosmological constant. So it's very tantalizing to think, okay, I can start from a rather philosophical statement that space and time should be treated equally and they are both discrete. And then I can get to an observation, the fact that the universe expands accelerating.
So usually time is a clock.
Yeah.
And so what would be the clock here? Well, I mean, I don't get the connection between the clock and...
You're right, because what we do usually in general relativity in order to talk about clocks is to introduce some physical and matter entity, for instance, a scalar field working as a clock and so on. One possibility, well, from cosmology, we know other possibilities. For instance, if you have anisotropies, you can treat one of the spatial dimension direction as your clock and evolve the other two with respect to this, to the first one. Well, I don't know because I haven't worked out yet how to do it. So, but my guess would, just inspired from what is done in cosmology, is that as soon as I don't consider just homogeneous and isotropic space, then I can work out some notion of change that works as a clock. I don't know, this is something I, as I said, we need more students, critical mass to work on this. But I think it's something possible. I think I don't have a better idea than this. I thought instead that your question would have been about the passage from Euclidean to Lorentzian space-time, because so the next thing to do is to try to understand better what happens if instead of working with the 3D Euclidean space-time, I work with 4D Lorentzian space-time.
Say that this is actually time. When you write time spaceness?
Oh wait.
In time, the
spaceness
that you're talking about? Or
wait. So the point is that so in this relation here, what I'm doing is that I start from the extrinsic curvature. I know that this extrinsic curvature, by definition, gives me a rate of change in the metric. So this rate of change should be associated with some change that comes in steps, in discrete steps. This is what I'm saying. Well, I don't know. Again, we are back to the previous issue.
In principle, if the initial extrinsic metric, the final extrinsic metric, you can compute how much proper time it is. Because you have a metric in between, so.
Okay.
And the first order is just.
And that just uses like what is proper time with respect to each clock. Where a clock
then
would
but
be.
But then there's a matrix, and then.
It's a proper time that would be the proper time in the classical geometry that would be between
yeah.
each of the time.
Is that dependent on which observers?
Suppose otherwise, it's like if I have the initial position and momentum of a particle and the final position of a particle, then I have to compute how much time it's lost. I can do the same job.
You cannot dream.
It's not. It's a funny way of measuring proper time, but in principle, if I have a local geometry, I can measure proper time. And I can do the random.
How can you measure at the same time intrinsic and extrinsic geometry if they are conjugated?
You can, you cannot. If you have in the classical theory, there's an expression of proper time as a function of intrinsic probabilities.
Well, I can
there
see
is no way of defining that way a quantum operator because it's done out of true.
No, that's kind of, we have to define this quantum operator on the physical Hilbert space and that. There's some other connections.
There are two different arguments. One is that given in the classical theory, that's classical, given the boundary values, you can compute the proper time, the expression of the classical. Now, a second argument is link by link, if the Hilbert space is finite dimensional, any link that you define is discrete level. Whatever you do, necessarily, is discrete level. So once you're down to a finite dimensional Hilbert space, anything you it's right, but
yeah,
it's
no,
like
yeah,
the time,
yeah, no,
it's like
I
the time operator in finite
but,
dimensional quantum mechanics, a function of being cubed.
But you can only define this operator usefully on the physical Hilbert space.
But let me separate this. How do you find an angular momentum with P and Q cannot? The angular momentum is P times Q. How could you define it with P and Q and Q?
Well, the momentum P1 is with S2, but the point of your question is right. You can construct an operator out of it to operate that don't commute with each other by assigning it.
Okay, but
No, but eventually the question you're asking is a good idea. No. So indeed you could finally define an operator which gives you the proper time and subsequent test limit between two states, between two boundary states. But you can only define this on a physical Hilbert space because it doesn't make any sense on the kinematic one. Okay.
But it's a dispute between you and you, right? That's right. So, I mean, you have two different points of view, right?
Maybe we should postpone that fight until the end of this talk.
Well, actually,
so there's still a question how the physical Hilbert space looks like.
Yeah.
Which might not be finite dimension.
Well, I'm glad that we are already into the discussion because I wanted only to add one more comment and then this is the conclusion of my talk. So what I have presented so far is my work with Carlo that has been published. And the next thing to do is to understand if these operators can be useful and they stay the same in the 4D theory. And I love this idea of discrete time, as you see. Here we are. So in order to work out the 4D theory, so the first thing is to define our variables. And we know, thanks to Aldo and thanks to Florian and MIT that, and Etera, that we can work out how to associate a group element. Now, not to links, but I can associate now them to faces following the construction in these works. And What happens now to the operator I have defined? Well, my expectation is that when I go to the 4D case, since we are concerned only with the kinematics of the theory, not with the dynamics, so on the kinematical level, we are still talking about SU2 states. And when I act with this operator on SU2 states, the action of this operator is on links, not on the intertwiners. So my expectation is that I can keep this operator to be valid also in the 4D case. And this is where we are now, and I'm happy to resume the discussion that we were having before.
So, you expect a really huge lighting?
Yeah, the point is that, Bianca was raising some concerns, but the naive way to do those things is just to take your loop quantum gravity framework, and wherever you have a 3J symbol, you replace it with a quantum 3J symbols. So this is the case for H. I have shown before that I expect the same to happen also for the operator corresponding to fluxes. So there should be quantum deformation also.
What I meant is that in the Lorentzian case, in positive cross continuity constant, you expect Q to be real and not the root of unity. In particular, you don't expect to implement a cutoff on the speeds, right?
No, this is something I disagree about. So I've been mumbling about this a lot because, of course, when you are working with SL2C, of course, SL2C is non-compact. But then in loop quantum gravity, we work with unitary reducible representations of SL2C. So you can decompose SL2C in matrix, a diagonal block matrix, and each of these block corresponds to SU2, right? Labeled by a certain representation, J. So, and usually this thing runs with J to infinity, and so I'm proposing just to take a deformation of SL2C, where there is a maximal J in the matrix. So you have
But I think mathematicians didn't prove that this was a consistent way to work. I mean, SL2C with Q was infinity. I don't think that they know the representation theory, so I don't think the math means.
That's a great occasion because finally loop quantum gravity can open a new research path for mathematicians.
Even supposing you can. In the Lorentzian case and positive cross-continuity constant, you expect to have hyperbolic geometries. To describe hyperbolic geometries, hence non-compact geometries, right? So geometrically compactness is due to the fact that you close up levers. If you're in a Euclidean and positive cross-continuity constant case, you essentially describe spherical geometries.
But do you agree that I can forget about the math? Do you agree?
Go ahead.
Well, we live in.
But you can describe this in space as a little compact.
Even more, if it's not too rare to say so, we don't live in the space. We live in the universe with the preferred foliation of time.
Right.
And. Even if with the cosmological constant, so if one is willing to break the decision invariance in the formulation of gravity, for some people that's heretical, but for some that would be conservative gesture.
In any case, one can just replace as it with the
cosmological,
which then might not have something to do directly with the cosmological constant.
Okay.
But this
so I have a related question. What are the boundary states of EPRL quantum deform?
Well, that's a question we can get to.
So here Q is real. So
EPRL would define with
For example, in our discussion, in our discussion, which is we didn't have the full quantization of the thing, but it was hinting towards having boundary states which look more or less like this. But the bulk theory, the SL2C one, is something that, as Ferrano said, that is not has not been worked out by the mathematician. It is even related to something even worse than what you point to, that is SL2C Simons, which is already problematic, with complex level, which is even worse. So in that sense, I don't know how to comment about the quantumness of the bulk. But I mean, so it seems that boundary states, okay, they are related to quantum groups, but the bulk might be even something that is not related to quantum groups at all, or something more general. There is no law of nature saying that quantum groups should travel the night.
Yeah. And maybe we will know more about this in a couple of weeks when you will publish the new paper? No. Well, about the corresponding classical geometry, at least. Yeah, go ahead.
You haven't mentioned...
Oh, Lee, you had a, it was the comments about...
No, after you. Okay. You haven't mentioned the work by Alejandro and Daniele.
And
so here the
yes. So there is the work by Alejandro Perez, by Daniele Pranzetti, and this is something I was referring at the beginning, in the sense that. So how do you implement the cosmological constant in the theory? You can do it in the dynamics,
right.
Or you can do it. In the states, in the kinematics, or you can do both. So what Alejandro and Daniele were arguing for is that it's enough that you focus on the dynamics. So yeah.
Probably equivalent constructions, in a sense. So what their analysis suggests, at least in this one, is that you don't need to modify the kinematics.
Well, my impression is that it depends on the kind of question you want to ask and the regime in which you are.
I think it depends on just the final answer is the answer with the dynamics implemented. Whatever you do, you should solve the dynamics at some point.
Yeah.
So it's just a matter of the order of in which you do things.
It might be. It's not fine for anyone,
yes,
sure.
Yeah. I think. There are conceptual reasons for which you may like this picture. So,
when you put Wilson observables into Simons, at the beginning, you don't think about putting a cuneiform trace of some holonomy. You just put the trace of some holonomies, then you calculate the expectation value to discover the complicated interplay between the connections appearing in the observable and that appearing in the action gives you quantum group. A priori, well, so it depends in which way you...
Because you have to find the...
Yes.
The pattern go well.
Yeah, there are many... Well, in fact, one can... a way to see that is... one can rewrite the trace as essentially as an action, again, and this action modifies somehow there is an interplay, so in a sense, and considering them both together is different than considering one.
Yeah, I have a comment and it'll become a question that takes us in a little bit different direction. If you really think that the underlying dynamics is discrete, and the Hilbert space is discrete, then a classical analog is maybe something simpler than some compact phase space. A classical analog could be just a discrete dynamic system with a discrete series of states, a discrete set of states.
You have in mind something like causal sets or...
I have in mind something like a cellular automaton.
or I mean, there are many discrete dynamical systems where there's a finite set of states in a deterministic map, which is the evolution world. And then I would just observe that those that are reversible, that have reversible deterministic dynamics, are very small, correspond to unitary evolution in quantum theory. Are a very small set, and there's an easy generalization to the general case, which is an irreversible discrete dynamical system. And I think that's worth contemplating in terms of trying to understand the outer time.
Yeah. See your point. For the moment, I'm more fond to a perspectival point of view about the arrow of time, namely that it depends on the observable that you consider, the flash of the arrow of time. But it's an interesting point you're making, yeah. So it would be interesting to see if we... So there are all those results in...
If you have a reversible discrete dynamical system classically, finite state discrete dynamical system, it's basically a set of cycles.
Yeah.
And it's easy, and it's such a set is always the limit set of an irreversible system where you add on to it states that converge to the cycles.
I have a question for you. So the irreversibility should come from some form of dissipation. So yeah. What is the dissipation?
Dissipation is that the limit set, you start off with a set of states, which is larger than the limit states that the sets do evolve to. You evolve always to cycles. If you have a discrete deterministic dynamical system, there's a discrete deterministic evolution rule, and eventually it brings you into a cycle. Because eventually...
Another question. Why, in physics, we know irreversibility is always hard to reach?
Not always hard. There are other aspects of irreversibility, such as the absence of events, electromagnetic waves.
The absence?
Advanced electromagnetic waves. We never see coherent waves carrying information from the future. So all the solutions to Maxwell's equation, some of them carry coherent information from the past, some of them carry coherent information from the future. A generic solution to Maxwell's equation does both. And we restrict ourselves by boundary conditions to a very small subset of solutions that only carry coherent information from the past. Future. And this requires explanations. It's separate. There's a point that Steve Weinstein makes very effectively. It's under the tutelage of Steve Weinstein, philosopher of physics there.
But it's still a
very utility. One can do very
much.
It's not obviously. I think it's there have been attempts to relate to heat. But it's not.
It was very hot under the skies.
In the context of the wheel of finite theory, one attempted to understand that context. But whether or not it's related to heat, it shares with the fact that to understand the irreversibility of the present universe, you have to assume that the initial conditions were very different from the final conditions. So you have to assume. Even if you have time-symmetric laws, you only make sense of our universe in the context of time, highly asymmetric initial or boundary conditions, which require explanation. So Penrose's hypothesis, which I think we should consider, is that the underlying quantum gravity laws are time asymmetric, and that's what sets up the things that look like very improbable initial conditions.
But how come that in our everyday life it's sort of the similarity cancels and then we
because
have to there's heat?
Because it's very generic, at least in this large class of discrete dynamical systems, it's very generic that irreversible systems evolve to reversible systems. Because any generic discrete dynamical system, which is finite state, evolves to shrinks to a limit set, which is a product of cycles.
In math, but not in physics. I agree, math is true, but not in physics. If you go to a lab, you pose yourself in a lab, and you want to make experiments, there are two alternatives. Either it's reversible or it brings heat. There's no way to argue this in a lab. Why?
We're far from the Stephen scale, so there's a continuous approximation to the. Basically, we fool ourselves, but the fundamental dynamics under the, this is a hypothesis, right? The fundamental dynamics under this hypothesis is irreversible, but we only see the limit cycles or the limit set, which is evolution around cycles. We only see evolution in one direction around cycles, because the evolution was deterministic, so we actually only go one way around the cycle, corresponding to the absence of advanced solutions of electromagnetism. But because the evolution is one-to-one, we fool ourselves into thinking it's reversible. We never actually see the time reverse of most of the processes we see. That's the picture. It's a big conjecture, it's a big dynamic.
Didn't Tufte work out some specific models?
Yeah.
He was training tech.
Yeah, and I was ignoring him for a long time, but until it was recently here, I understood that he's actually he still doesn't understand, I think, locality versus non-locality, but in terms of getting a reversible unitary dynamics to appear to emerge from an irreversible discrete dynamics, he's been making sense for 15 years. And I don't know about anybody else, but I at least have done plenty of that.
Oh, yeah, I agree with. So the one part of the story is the fact that so there are good reasons to consider discrete systems, even at fundamental level in quantum foundations of quantum mechanics. Let's say trying to implement in the quantum and to see what are the consequences if you do quantum mechanics with discrete time step. So, and then I don't know if. If one model is better to the other, but this seems to push people to work on this direction. Yeah.
Any further comments or questions? No, then that's fantastic.